You're listening to another episode of the Young Investors Podcast, so sit back and relax as myself, Brandon, and my buddy Hamish discuss the latest in the world of finance and stock market investing. Now, a quick reminder before we get into the podcast is that nothing in this podcast should be taken on as personal financial advice. If you're ever unsure about your finances or investing and you need some help, make sure you reach out to a qualified financial advisor. But with all that said, let's get into another episode of the Young Investors Podcast. Welcome back, everybody. What's going on, Hamish? How you doing, mate?
Yeah, I'm doing well. A little bit sleepy this morning. Hype myself up for the podcast this morning. Happens every now and then. But Melbourne had an interesting event yesterday. We had an earthquake, which doesn't happen.
What happened there?
Yeah, it was really strange. We don't have them very often at all. But I think it was a 5.8 or a 6 magnitude.
Wow.
So pretty strong. And it just kind of started off. The house was rattling a little bit. And sometimes this house does that when there's a really strong wind, like a very minor rattle. So I was like, oh, it's just the wind. And then it just kept getting stronger and stronger. I was like, wow. Went on for about 30 seconds. So
30 seconds?
Yeah.
Wow.
It was pretty long.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So that happened. I think there wasn't too much damage. There was one property, I think on Chapel Street in Melbourne, that was pretty badly damaged. Don't know what they made that out of, but as far as I'm aware, I don't think anyone was hurt or anything. So yeah, but there you go. That doesn't happen very often in Melbourne. So.
Yeah, I've only experienced one earthquake, and it only went for 2 seconds, if that.
Oh.
But it was in Canberra, which is really weird. I just don't imagine Canberra to be a likely spot to have an earthquake. And it was only tiny. It just the earth shook very minorly and then that was it. But so bizarre, man. I just remember that feeling. It feels so weird. I guess maybe if you live in a higher risk area, you're probably maybe more used to earth moving kind of activity. But I guess we're not very used to it here in Australia. What are they called? Fault lines or something?
Yeah, the tectonic plates, I think. We're not over any of them. I had a quick look afterwards. Yeah, look, I don't know anything about how earthquakes work, but I presume they're much more severe along those lines. We don't get them very often. I know that New Zealand is over one, which is why they often have some pretty severe ones that are quite bad. So, yeah.
Also why it's so mountainous in New Zealand.
There you go. Little fun fact for today from the Young Investors Podcast. I also got my first jab yesterday. So
oh, did you?
Yeah. Nice. So I'm on my way to being.
How long
protected.
Is it between? Is it 3 weeks or 2 weeks?
It's 3 to 8 weeks. So I'm gonna try and get mine in just over 3 weeks. So not too long. Not too far now. Yeah.
I've got my first jab on the 29th. So. Just under a week.
Ah, okay.
Just under a week. That should be good.
Yeah. Very good.
Yeah, originally I was going to get one on when was it? The 3rd of November or something like that, quite a way away. But I don't know, something came out in the news saying, look, if you've booked in, go and try and schedule it. You can get an appointment sooner. So, I was like, all right. And I did.
Yeah.
So, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. We had we had some feedback, I think, I think you've written this down. I didn't take a look yet from last week's podcast.
Yeah. Remember last week we were talking about companies that are private that we wish were public, that we wish we could invest in.
Yes.
And we actually, we posed the question out to the audience if they had any ideas on private companies that they would be interested in investing in if they were able to. So, I'll read out a few of them. We had Sean O said Patagonia, the clothing brand. I thought that was a good one.
That's a good one. Yeah. They make good clothing. I have a Patagonia. I have some clothes from Patagonia. So, yeah.
We had- Yeah, it was definitely a good one. We had Sean C and the investing book highlights on YouTube said Lego. How good's that one?
That's a good one. Yes. I think because Lego has a patent for their blocks, I think. So, it's only they can make them in that specific way, I'm pretty sure. So,
right.
Yeah, fascinating business. Certainly has one of those iconic brand moats around it as well.
Yeah.
That demands a significant premium when you go and buy Lego things at the store. So, yeah, very interesting. Any others?
Absolutely. Yeah, we had Max. Max said Bloomberg.
Okay, yeah.
And Jonathan says Publix, which is a grocery chain in southeastern US states.
Right.
And Marco said Aldi as well. Aldi's a good one.
Oh, yeah. Aldi is a good one. Aldi's kind of, I guess, kind of in the direction that Costco is going, although, of course, they don't have a membership fee, but they kind of go for the, you know, they don't really care too much about what their store looks like. They kind of just slap stuff out there and they don't pack your bags for you. It's kind of very minimalist, I guess. And as a result, they can pass on that cost saving to the customers. So, they kind of have a little bit of some of the characteristics that Costco has. So, yeah, it's an interesting business.
Very good. Yeah, I thought that was some good ideas from the audience. So, thanks for sending those in.
Thank you.
If you have any more, send them through. We'd love to hear them. But we should move on. So, in today's episode, there's been some pretty major stuff happening in the markets over the past week. I imagine most of this podcast will probably be spent talking about this Evergrande crisis that seems to be unfolding literally as we speak. In fact, some of the stuff we talk about today, like the podcast will go out in a few days from us recording this. So, a lot of the stuff you might already have updates to by the time you hear this. We'll also talk about Michael Burry for a little bit. He's been
he's
classic
back.
Burry. He's back. He's back, baby. Back on Twitter. There's a Fed meeting that's going down today, and then hopefully we'll get to some Q&A if we've got time, but it's going to be a big podcast. So, let's get into it, eh?
Yeah. Today's episode is sponsored by ShareSite, which is an application that you can use to track the performance of your stock portfolio. So, you can bring in all of your trades from the past either automatically by connecting it to your broker, or you can do it manually or through Excel. And once you do that, it will track all of the different types of gains. So, capital gains, dividends. If you have dividend reinvestment plans, it will do all of those calculations for you. Currency gains if you're buying shares internationally or you hold foreign currencies. And it will basically just give you a really transparent and accurate view of your overall return, which is something that is really hard to get. I mean, if you just look at your broker and the return that they show you, usually they'll show you maybe total return. They probably won't include the cost of trading in that. They probably won't include dividends or reinvested shares. So, it's very difficult to get an overall view of what your portfolio return actually has been without using something like ShareSite. And then you can also use it for when it comes to tax time. So, you can generate up to 12 different reports that can be used to track the performance of your portfolio and also use that tax time to work out things such as your capital gains, dividend income, and more. And at the moment, you can try ShareSite for free by heading over to ShareSite.com/young investors. That's site spelled S-I-G-H-T, ShareSite.com/young investors. So, use that link, sign up to a free plan, track up to 10 holdings for free forever. Or you can also use that link to get 4 months off a yearly subscription if you pay for a premium plan. And thanks to everyone who has used that link when signing up to ShareSite and is supporting the podcast. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, here we go. Here we go.
Here we go.
Wind me up. This is a very, very long, very intricate news story this week. I guess we should start talking about Evergrande, right?
Yeah. It's fair to say this has consumed a lot of time from both of us and a lot of other people sharing news on this and making content in the finance space at the moment because it's a really complex issue, like a lot of these things are, but it's important to understand. I think there can be some kind of consequences and outcomes that affect investors, even all the way over here in Australia.
Yeah. All right. So, apologies. We like to go back and forth a lot on this podcast, but this is going to be me talking for a little while, I think. Feel free to just interrupt me, Hamish, if you've got something to add.
Yeah.
Okay. So, Evergrande. Okay, it's the world's second largest property developer by sales. It's huge. It's gigantic. It's in China. Okay. They build mainly apartments in China's Guangdong province. And for those that these guys, they basically just run off of leverage. They just love to leverage. They buy, you know, they'll build one apartment block, enables you to build two apartment blocks, enables you to build four, so on and so forth. It's just all of this real estate development is just built on leverage. So these developers have just insane levels of debt. In fact, Evergrande has $305 billion of liabilities, making it the most indebted developer in the world. So that's a kind of build up. For example, in 2019, their debt to equity ratio was 240%. Hamish, would you be interested in investing?
That's horrific. That makes me sweat. That makes me nervous. And I mean, this isn't just a big company in China as well. It's 122, number 122 on the Fortune's global financial, global 500 list of biggest companies by revenue. So it's the 122nd biggest company by revenue in the world. So this is a huge company, not only just in China, but globally. $305 billion in debt is horrific. That makes me not
cringe.
I don't feel good. I feel sick now.
Keep down your breakfast. All right. So yeah, obviously lots and lots and lots and lots of debt. And it's a little bit worrying because while you say it's like, oh, you know, oh, it's the 22nd largest Fortune company in the world, we got to remember that this is quite an important company in terms of the economy, especially like China's economy, because it is the second largest real estate developer, which, yeah, obviously has major economic implications. So here's what's happened, right? So in August 2020, the Chinese government, they introduced new laws to force real estate developers to deleverage because they saw this problem coming. So they thought, you know what? We've got the power. Let's put in some laws and let's force them to just cool things off a little bit so we don't get some major disaster. Part of the reason for that is I didn't know this. I don't understand a lot of this China kind of contextual stuff, but the most popular investment by choice in China, by a long way, is property. And I was learning that it's not uncommon for multiple generations of families to save up just to put a deposit down on a property to invest in. And the reason that it's so common and popular is everyone's doing it. So it seems like a no-brainer because everyone's doing it. House prices have just continued to grow because there's just always people buying. So when you look at the growth in house prices in China, they've been growing at like between 5% and 15% per year, some years 20% growth, 25% growth. And it's been doing that for quite a long time. So people are just, buying property like crazy. People are calling around the world are calling China's property market like a massive bubble. But of course, these conditions mean for developers that they want to try and build more and more and more as much as they possibly can because they see that demand. They see how much they can sell this commodity for, that is a house or an apartment in China. So they just want to keep building and building and building. But obviously, you can understand that the CCP, they were seeing this thing turn quite bubbly. So they wanted to impose new rules to essentially just stabilize the sector. They wanted to just make sure that it was, you know, not going to explode in everyone's faces because so many people's wealth is exposed to house prices in China. So one of the rules that they imposed is that you need to get, so this is for developers, you need to get your debt to equity ratio down to a maximum of 100%. Okay. And as we said before, the problem is that this company's debt to equity ratio in 2019 was 240%. So they had to get their debt levels down.
On the surface, that's like a good thing, right? It sounds good. Like we want businesses, we want to kind of push businesses in the direction or force them in this case to have less debt, to be a safer business, operate at a safer level. So the implementation, you know, what the effect of the law change is one thing, but the idea behind it, I think, is it had good intentions, I think.
I think that's a fair point. Definitely good intentions. So, and what we're talking about, so I'll just explain it a little bit more in a little bit more depth. So technically, these rules that I'm talking about is part of a larger set of rules called the three red lines. So the three red lines are liability to asset ratio has to be less than 70%, net gearing ratio less than 100%, and cash to short-term debt ratio of more than 1x. So if you meet all three of those criteria, this is the rule. If you meet all three of the criteria, then you're allowed to grow your debt 15% per year. And then if you meet two of the criteria, you can only grow it by 10%. If you hit one of the criteria, only 5%. And if you meet none of the criteria, you aren't allowed to grow your debt levels. So what this means for Evergrande is obviously they're not hitting these metrics. So then they're not allowed to grow their debt, which means that they can't, and they have to get their debt levels down to hit these various factors, so they can then meet the requirements and continue to grow their debt into the future. So the problem is that they can't really roll over their debt. Essentially, oftentimes when a debt comes due, and a lot of companies do this, a debt will come due and they fold the old loan, they turn it into a new loan. They essentially, you know, they make it tomorrow's problem. They just say, yep, debt's coming due, great, let's turn it into a new debt that we'll pay later down the track. But, you know, they're not allowed to do that now. So when debt comes due, they literally have to pay it. So they have to try and get their debt to equity ratio down. So whenever they make money, they're just essentially any cash flow that they're making, it's just like, all right, pay down debt, pay down debt, pay down debt. So if they've got another debt due, they just pay it off, or, you know, they use up their cash, they sell, you know, properties, they do whatever they need to, and they just pay down this debt. And as you can tell, over time, they've now got so much debt coming due, they can't roll it over. And now essentially they just can't pay it back.
Yeah.
And that's the real pickle that they're in.
Yeah. And I mean, that's just that idea right there of not being able to refinance and roll over that debt is the reason why both of us have such a strict focus on businesses that don't have debt, because even though these requirements don't exist, at least as far as I'm aware, in the US, for example, businesses can have, you know, a significant amount of debt on their books and they can roll it over. Every now and then are situations where you can't roll it over, not because the government's saying you can't, but because the credit markets just freeze up. That's what happened in 2008. A lot of businesses were expecting to just continue to roll over debt. They just love having debt on the balance sheet because it's a cheap way to get money. And then all of a sudden, there was just nobody willing to buy the debt bonds from them. You know, it's a similar situation where in this case, it's a government that's forcing them to not roll over that debt. But that's the risk with businesses that do have a lot of debt, is they expect that on a short-term basis, they can just get new debt and pay their interest payments. And in some cases, eventually that's not the case anymore. You know, that's kind of what's going on with this business, is they can't roll over those debts. They have to pay them. And that's just, you know, they're not in a situation to do that currently.
Yeah, exactly. And this is direct from, I think, an Al Jazeera article. It says here, China Evergrande Group missed interest payments due on Monday to at least two of its largest bank creditors, taking the cash-strapped developer a step closer to one of the nation's biggest debt restructurings. Evergrande hadn't made the payments as of late Tuesday local time. And I still don't believe they have. But anyway, they also, this is where it's starting to get a bit sticky. They also have two notes due on Thursday, including $83.5 million of interest on an 8.25% five-year US dollar bond. Mm. For that bond, luckily for them, there is a 30-day period before a missed payment is considered a default. And then Evergrande also needs to pay a 232 million yuan or 36 million US dollar coupon on an onshore bond on the same day. So they've got these payments that are coming due in, well, today, really. So by the time that this comes out, you guys will already know the outcome of that. But I think we kind of already know the outcome to at least one of those payments. They said that, I believe late yesterday, the company said they will be paying the onshore bond coupon. But the questions are whether they're going to be able to make the other one. Because yeah, if they don't make it, then it essentially, as I said before, it starts that 30-day ticking time bomb where they have to pay it before it's considered a default.
Yeah. They're in a massive scramble right now to do a couple of things. One is, of course, come up with the money to make these payments, but also in the same period, they're also trying to restructure these deals, renegotiate, and basically just stop lenders from making that final call of, yes, you need to pay us right now. Because when they make that call, if Evergrande does not have the money, this is kind of the 30-day grace period, 30 days after the payment is due. If they don't have the money, then they're no longer solvent and that's when they will have to fold into bankruptcy. So they're everyone's calling it a ticking time bomb, a scramble right now to either sell some assets, come up with some money, or to renegotiate these deals so that they don't have to make these payments if they don't have the money for it.
Yeah, exactly. They also have a $47.5 million payment due on September the 29th. So, that's coming up
next week
as well. But here's the crazy thing is that people are looking at what's coming, you know, down the pipe in like the next week or two. In total, Evergrande has $669 million in coupon payments coming due through the end of this year. So, even if they get through the next couple of weeks and they find a way, it's not like it just stops there. It's not like, oh, crisis avoided. Well done, guys. You know, kick up your heels. Everyone gets a pay rise. Well done. We scrape through. Let's focus on building more apartments. No, they still have an insane amount of money that they need to pay. And because of those new rules, they can't simply roll it over. And that's really the problem. So, this is not something that's just going to, well, it could end quickly because it could just be like, yep, we're bust. Sorry, guys. So, it could end like that. But if they do scramble and find a way to get past it, then it's not like it's just going to go away. There's continuing. I was looking at a chart for like the next few years of all of the debt and payments that are coming due, and it looks like they very much have a big uphill battle.
Yeah, it looks it's not looking good. I mean, look, we're not experts in looking at all the financials and saying, yeah, they can't make these payments. They don't have the money. We're really kind of just relying on the expertise of other people who are, you know, working closely in this field. But it looks very much like at this point, according to a lot of experts, that they're probably going to fail. And then it really comes down to whether they're going to get a bailout or not. If it comes to that, you know, maybe that's not a certainty at this point, but you know, if it does come to that, will the Chinese government bail them out? Will it protect them? Will they protect their customers that they owe money to, their employees that they actually owe, not only the employees which will lose their jobs, but that they actually got money from employees. Employees actually lended money to Evergrande. They set up this scheme that offered employees high interest investments. A lot of those people may very well lose their money from not only lose their job, but also lose money that they gave to the company to fund some of their developments. So, there's a lot on the line. So, I don't know what we will see from the Chinese government is whether or not they'll step in if it comes to that, or they'll let it fail. But maybe we should talk probably a little bit about why it's a concern for us, because I think a lot of the time you might think, well, okay, this is a company, you know, so far away from me in China. You know, what impact does that have on me and my investments, say in the US or in Australia, for example? And I think the word of the month at the moment, if you're watching any coverage of this, is contagion. Everyone loves the word contagion at the moment. And it's basically the idea that everything in financial markets is connected in some way. And when you have big disruptions in one area of the market, it can have massive ripple effects, not only through, say, the property industry in China, but through other sectors in China, and then even across other regions to have impacts in the US and other areas and Europe and Australia, for example. So, everyone is concerned that there's going to be what's called contagion, that it's going to be there's going to be a ripple effect into other asset classes and into other markets. So just to kind of go through, I guess, like a couple of sort of effects that you would maybe expect to see. First of all, if there is a default, if this company does default, there is very likely going to be massive impacts on the Chinese economy. Evergrande's debt reflects 6.5% of all of the debt in the Chinese property sector. So, they, they are a big chunk of the entire Chinese property sector, which is crazy to think about. And I think property, I think it represents like 20 or 25% of the Chinese GDP. It's huge. Wow. It is massive. So, obviously, not only is this going to have an effect on the business, but also the property sector and then the rest of China. So, you know, how that kind of looks in reality is, of course, people at Evergrande will lose their jobs. Customers who have given deposits and are expecting properties won't get their deposits back. They won't get the properties they're expected. There'll be suppliers that don't get paid. There'll be construction companies that are expecting payments from Evergrande that will then maybe go out of business. Maybe they have high levels of debt and they won't be able to function from not getting payments from Evergrande. There will be a massive increase in the supply of houses going onto the market because there'll be all these unfinished skyscrapers and projects and apartments that go onto the market as creditors try and get pennies on the dollar for their money. So, you know, these are all things that have a massive outward effect across China and then also across the rest of the world. Because as the overall Chinese economy slows down because of this, or if it does, you know, it's going to impact things such as US businesses who sell to China. So if China's economy slows down, if businesses are doing worse, they'll be buying less, if they'll be doing less importing of certain things. That's a particular concern for Australia, which does a significant amount of exports to China for things such as iron. I think iron's down 30% or something.
Iron's down massive.
Iron is hurting a lot because, you know, China generally uses a lot of iron and imports a lot of iron from Australia, but it's also, of course, a key component in a lot of property development. So that's, you know, that's one example of an impact that goes outward from China. And then there's also a significant amount of debt in China that's in US dollars, and that's from the US. So there's a flow-on effect of when those, if some of those debts default, that you have US financial institutions that are losing money as a result of that. And then, of course, those financial institutions have investments globally in the US, but also other in Europe, for example. So that's kind of just a little bit of an example of how things can kind of ripple out and how it's not just, oh, Evergrande fails and their employees lose their jobs and the business goes out of business and that's it. You know, no one else is affected. Yeah. It has a massive effect, particularly when it's a really big business. We all remember parts of the Lehman Brothers 2008, and how their collapse had started a massive trickle effect that impacted the global economy. And I think in that case, Lehman Brothers had about $600 billion in debt. So, they were about twice as big on a debt basis as Evergrande. But, you know, we don't know what's going to happen with this. Of course, we have no idea what this is going to look like, if they're going to get a bailout, whether they'll even fail, what effects it has. But it can have a big effect. So, it's certainly something we kind of want to be paying attention to and watching as it unfolds over the next few weeks and months.
Yeah, I'm just reading even like what you were saying before, how it could impact you. Like, oh, I'm sitting here in Melbourne or in Canberra or wherever. It's like, how's this going to impact me in over in Australia? And it's just like, I'm just reading a headline here that China's iron ore imports have just hit a 13-month low. And if you start to see why the second largest developer, real estate developer, go bust, and then suppliers don't get paid, and you know, property market starts to crash, and that means that more developers start to implode, then it's like all of a sudden China, which I believe is the world's biggest consumer of iron, is just like the demand has just dried up because everyone's gone bust, and then all of a sudden, okay, well, now the iron ore price has crashed so hard, we've got all these iron ore miners in Australia, and now they're not able to sell their iron for very much. They're not turning a profit. Some of those companies might fold, and then they have to let go of their workers. Their workers can't find jobs. They start defaulting on their mortgages, and that hits our property market. Now, all of a sudden, there's increases in, you know, defaults, and house prices start going going down in Australia. And it's just a massive chain effect. You can look at it from so many different angles.
Yeah.
The Australian angle is probably more to do with this iron ore.
Yeah.
But yeah, like different angles, you can look at, it's really crazy just like how important some companies are to the smooth functioning of so many different economic, you know, factors, I guess. It's really crazy.
Yeah. But, yeah. I think, I mean, particularly the China-Australia relation is interesting in this case because of how much China does. Well, I mean, China's industrial sector is massive and Australia plays a big role in that. We export.
We feed it.
Yeah, we feed it. It's not just iron, it's coal. It's a bunch of other minerals, you know, whether or not you agree with that or not, that's one thing, but you know, it's a big part of the Australian economy. You know, if that goes down, then those are, or if that, you know, has an impact, then those are real people, a lot of real people in Australia who maybe they're making less money or they're not making money anymore. And then that has an effect on other segments of the economy. So Everything is connected and we'll kind of see what happens in the future with this and how it unfolds. And, you know, these things, you know, they're often, you know, sometimes the first event seems like it's going to be a catalyst for a lot of negative things to come, and it isn't. And sometimes it is. I mean, what were we speaking about? Bill Huang and massive collapse, that fund in China. I think it was in China. It was like a $30 billion collapse or something. Yeah,
the family fund.
Yeah. And
now I can't, all I can hear is Evergrande now.
Yeah.
Archegos.
Archegos. Yeah, that's it. Yeah. So, I mean, that was a massive collapse. And at the time, everyone was thinking, well, are there more of these? Are we going to see a domino effect of these? And look, it hasn't really been that long since that happened. So, maybe there are more of them. But, you know, maybe that's just a one-off event, right? And, you know, that's kind of an example of how, you know, people love to, I think it's important to understand what's going on and appreciate, you know, how things are connected and what impacts they can have, but also realize that, you know, the media is going to drum up the fear of this event as well.
Absolutely.
That we really don't know what's going to happen. As much as people love to think, oh, this is the beginning of the end, you know, we might not be thinking about it too much more in the future. Yeah.
Yeah, pretty crazy. What a story, though. What a story.
Yeah, it's
pretty insane. And it's like, it's really interesting. The next week's going to be telling. But we won't have to wait and see for very long on this one, it sounds like, because we'll probably get a clearer picture in about a week's time, I would say.
Yeah. One thing I will say, I wanted to learn a little bit about the company. So I went and read last year's annual report and, man, their shareholder letter is very frothy. It's very positive. Yeah. So, and then I think last week or something was when the company communicated to shareholders, oh yeah, we might not be able to make payments. So, and I mean, the stock's already down, I think 90%+ from its origins. So, it's a bit of a disaster.
I read a funny comment the other day, which is like, man, this situation's crazy. This is the second big contagion in 2 years to come out of China. I thought that was quite funny.
Yeah, it's very, very on brand for the last couple of years. What else is coming? Come on. What else can we have? High inflation, another financial crisis.
Yeah. Makes interesting content to talk about. All right, should we move on?
Yeah, should we probably talk about Burry a little bit. Michael Burry's back. He's back in the Twitterverse. He's a little bit volatile at the moment.
He really is.
He comes on Twitter.
He's a loose, definition of a loose cannon.
Yeah, he is. He appears on Twitter. He tweets a bunch of things. He deletes some of them. He leaves some up and then he deletes his account and then he goes away for 3 months and then he comes back and does the same thing all over again. So, he spoke over the last couple of days. I think he's been back for a little while now, I think over a week, but in the last couple of days in particular, he kind of went on a bit of a Twitter storm. I don't know if he like blacks out and then he just tweets for 48 hours straight or something, but that seems to be what happens every now and then. But he spoke on a bunch of different topics and then, you know, in true Burry style, he deleted some of them. So some are still there. You can go check them out. Well, I mean, by Saturday, they'll probably be gone as well. But
yeah, but you can, just to butt in, sorry, you can just look up Michael Burry archive on Twitter.
Yeah.
If you want to see if something's been deleted, because Michael Burry archive, as the name suggests, has an archive of everything that he's put up on Twitter at one point or another.
Yeah. You beat me to it. Yeah. It's good that, it's good that those things exist, because, he's very quick to delete stuff, but the internet's forever. So
it
you,
is.
You can't hide on the internet, which is why I don't know why he bothers deleting them. I mean, he knows people are watching it like a hawk, and that people just copy them over onto their Twitters like that, or write articles about it. So anyway, but he's back. And I mean, we won't talk about everything that he spoke about, because he spoke about crypto and index funds and the Fed, and he spoke about Evergrande as well, and a lot of different things. So I'd recommend, checking in on his thoughts on some things, but taking it with a pinch of salt. I think he tweets without thinking a lot, but he said a couple of things that were really interesting to me. So one was he linked a research paper that basically found that US stocks have risen in terms of price on average $5 for every $1 invested, which is kind of crazy. So it's kind of illustrating the point that the markets are flowing up at a rate way higher. That's kind of disconnected to underlying fundamentals of businesses, right? Because if US stocks are going up at 5-to-1 investment, that kind of implies that businesses would be seeing a similar effect within their businesses. And that's obviously not happening. So as we know, stock prices are exploding relative to the underlying value of businesses. And he actually also argued that passive investing is playing a role in this and may exacerbate it. And that, that's of course the process of people buying index funds, not thinking about what they're buying, and just happy to pay basically any price to invest in the index, because, everyone has that kind of that quote, well, index funds for the past 100 years, the S&P 500 has done whatever it is, 8%, 6%. So if you just invest, it doesn't matter what you pay, you will make 6-8%. That's what a lot of people believe. And that drives a lot of investing that is not tied to underlying businesses. You're just buying the market because you think it will go up, not because you believe the businesses within it are worth the price you're paying. And he gave a quote from the tweet, which was, this is a knife's edge because we are at 5-to-1. So meaning for every dollar invested, the stocks go up $5. He said, it may go to 100-to-1 or it could become -5 to -1, but parabolas don't resolve sideways. So he's basically implying there that, as it's going up 5-to-1 right now, it could get worse. We don't really know. Like, he doesn't know where the, where the pinnacle will be or how bad it will get, but that things that go up irrationally like that tend to come down irrationally as well. Yeah. And that would mean, maybe a 5-to-1 up means a 5-to-1 down. For every dollar that someone is pulling out of the market, it causes the stock market to go down $5, which could cause a rapid decline in stock prices. So, I don't know. That was kind of one of the things that I kind of noticed from the selection of Burry's tweets there that I thought was interesting to kind of hear him reiterate those thoughts again on index funds.
Yeah, no, he's certainly in that camp that index funds are causing some wacky uptrends in the market. But one of the things that I found interesting in his latest kind of tweet rampage was he actually tweeted an article from Wall Street Journal, or part of the article, where he had a bit of a go at the Fed for using what he was saying kind of convenient metrics to judge inflation. And he is definitely of the opinion that the Fed is trying to downplay exactly how much inflation we're seeing in the US.
No, really?
Oh, Hamish, how do you crack me up? But yeah, so he's definitely of the opinion, if you've been living under a rock, that that's going on. And I actually read through the article, and it's quite interesting. The article wrote, and the bit that he posted references an interview that Jerome Powell did like a month ago, where he was saying that the Federal Reserve is using metrics such as the Dallas trimmed mean, as well as the 18-month PCE inflation or core PCE inflation ex durable goods and the 18-month total PCE inflation ex durable goods to guide their decision making. So
Powell comes out and he's like, yeah, to measure inflation across the US, we're actually just looking at the 63-day chart of apples, and it's currently at 1.5%. It's been there for a long time, so we're good.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what that sounds like.
Yeah,
18 months PCE inflation, removing durable goods, removing this, including this.
Yeah, make sure you add in lipstick, but remove toenail clippers. Yeah, exactly. It's just, and obviously Michael Burry's just reading this and he decided to put, he's just calling absolute BS on what the selective nature, shall we say, selective nature of their inflation analysis. Because what the article found is that conveniently, all three of the metrics that Jerome Powell quoted came out to an annual inflation rate of, can you guess?
2-3%.
Yeah, 2%. Exactly. Exactly right. When we're looking at inflation, it's coming out monthly figures like 5.3 or 5.4%. And then these three measures come out at 2%. And he's like, oh, look, it's all good. So I'll tell you a little bit more about these three measures. So for those that don't know, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, they track about 300 categories of goods and services. And then there are a whole number of different kind of, including this, excluding that, different measures that get taken around inflation. So the Dallas trimmed mean that Jerome Powell was talking about removes the top 31% of categories experiencing the most inflation and removes the bottom 24%. So remove the top 31%, but only remove the bottom 24%. So it's already is skewing towards the low side.
Yeah.
So there's that. And then the other two measures have are 18-month measures. So at the time that he gave this interview, that meant that their start point was before the pandemic. So now the change looks smaller because it actually bypasses the reduction in PCE and CPI that we saw early in 2020. So the change over 18 months looks much, you know, calmer than the change in the past 12 months, for example. And then for good measure, they also excluded the durable goods, which alone contributed 1 percentage point to that monthly inflation figure at the time of the quoted interview. So just 1% annual inflation from durable goods.
Jeez.
Yeah. So you can see, it seems like if you just had that explanation and you looked at Michael Burry, it's like, wow, the Federal Reserve, that the numbers they're quoting really are kind of bypassing some pretty important things. But to be completely fair, there's also a case to be made as to why the Federal Reserve would want to do this, because what they're trying to do with inflation is they're trying to find how much inflation is being brought on by their monetary policy. So they're trying to remove the temporary kind of supply demand inflation that they kind of expect to resolve itself in the short term, because no doubt, like we always say, oh, it's a transitory inflation, but no doubt some of the inflation we see is transitory, because over the past 12 months, so the price of stuff just works on a supply-demand equation. And over the past 12 months or 18 months now, 19 months, I think, but anyway, the supply-demand equation through lockdowns and supply chain constraints has just been just completely skewed. Like sometimes the supply has been high and the demand's been low because nobody's out and buying stuff. Other times we've seen supply really low and demand really high because there's a lockdown of some factory that, you know, and everybody in America's out and about, but the China factory is locked out. So it's just been all of these, you know, disruptions in supply demand, which the Fed do expect a lot of those to just, once everybody's up and running and everyone's vaccinated, then that's just going to resolve itself. So they're trying to work out how much of that. So I should say a lot of the inflation numbers we're seeing is because of this disruption to supply demand. But what the Fed's trying to work out is how much of this inflation is because is essentially lasting inflation because of them expanding the monetary supply, the money supply, which they've obviously been doing quite a bit in the last 12 to 18 months. And it's obviously, it's impossible to know. It's impossible to know how much is this, how much is that. So, what they're trying to do, which seems a little bit convenient for them because of the numbers that are working out in their favor, but what they're trying to do is, you know, exclude, they're trying to trim out the extremes up this end and the extremes down the lower end, and they're trying to remove the durable goods because that supply chain's been wildly disrupted, but they think that it might even out in the short term. So that's kind of why they, and they also do the 18 month as opposed to the 12 months, so that they do get the start point before the start of the lockdown, where everything just went whoa, you know.
Yeah, and I mean, to be fair, it does make sense to take a look at trying to remove the deflationary impact that was seen in 2020, to take a look at the prices of goods in, say, 2019 compared to them now.
Yeah,
that does make sense. The only kind of caveat I would have to that is when you look at the month-on-month data right now, that is not impacted by any means by what happened last year. We're not looking at year-over-year, just month-over-month. Month-over-month, we're still seeing 0.3%. Yeah. And if it stays at 0.3%, I can't remember what the exact figure was out over a year. Maybe I can do a really quick calculation while I'm talking. 3.7% per year inflation. So, at the current rate, not just looking at year-over-year, just if the current, what happened over the last couple of months, if that just continues for the next 12 months, we're still above the target. And we're how far out from the pandemic now? 18 months from when it, when 18, the 19? Severe depression in prices happened. And you know, there was still a lot of supply constraints this year. So maybe that's, you know, some of that effect is still in there. But yeah, I think ultimately you're right. We don't know. Like, we have no idea. They can try and meddle with the numbers and come up with a prediction, but we ultimately won't know until, you know, maybe we give it another, I don't know, how long do you give it? Do you give it another 6 months? And then you say, no, but we've still got supply constraints. Okay, another 6 months. No, we still have supply constraint.
When, 10 years later.
Yeah, what's the point at which supply constraints will have been resolved, right? And I guess that will depend from industry to industry. You know, like the semiconductor industry, for example, that shortage, I have no idea how long that takes to resolve, but I couldn't imagine it's, you know, more than a year, but maybe it is. And then maybe for other industries, it's much worse, right? So we don't know. We just have to keep watching it. If we're still here next year and inflation is still in the 3-4% range or higher, then I would be, you know, I would be kind of concerned if they're still calling it transitory inflation.
Yeah, fair.
But we'll see.
Hmm. That makes sense. But yeah, hopefully that gives you an idea of why Michael Burry's calling BS, but also why the Fed is doing it at the same time. So, there's always kind of two sides to the story there. But yeah, that's kind of what I had to talk about Michael Burry recently.
Yeah. And I mean, in relation to that, I mean, we can just move into what happened with the Fed this morning. So, I mean, there was a meeting. They did their monthly, I think it's monthly meeting, or maybe it's bi-monthly or something like that, where the Federal Reserve sits down and they talk about their monetary policy. And they really make two key decisions that we care about right now. One is whether they are going to change interest rates. So that's the official rate that they can lend money to, or the banks can get money from the Federal Reserve. And then also whether they will slow down or speed up or just leave it the same, the amount of money printing they're doing and buying of government bonds and mortgage-backed securities. So, those are the two kind of major things we care about. And from this meeting, you know, we still got a whole lot of, you know, not that much, but the Fed basically said they would start to wind back spending on asset purchases soon. They're currently spending $80 billion a month on treasury bonds. That's government bonds, government debt. And $40 billion on mortgage-backed securities per month. So, that's $120 billion in total per month. They're just printing money and buying those in the market.
That's crazy.
And if you don't understand why they would do that, like just focusing on the treasury bonds, the government debt, for example, the reason why they do it is to keep interest rates on those bonds low. So, the government at the moment is spending a lot of money. They're doing a lot of stimulus. They are providing money to businesses and individuals, and they're running big infrastructure projects in order to boost the economy and get it back on track. And to do that, they need to get money, right? And tax dollars doesn't cover it. So, they take on debt. And when they take on debt, they issue a bond. They say, hey, can somebody lend us money? And maybe someone in the public will buy a government bond and they will basically be lending money to the government. Maybe it's someone overseas will do it. But when there is a gap in the demand, when the government needs so much debt, but there's literally nobody there to fill the gap, that's when the Federal Reserve says, hey, we'll buy it from you. And they print money and they, well, they don't actually print money, but they, that's the kind of the,
they add zeros.
Yeah. They add zeros, right? They basically say, we'll give you money. They put money. Yeah. They add some zeros to the government's bank account.
Yeah, to the Fed's bank. Yeah. To asset balance sheet.
Yeah, exactly. So, that's kind of, you know, what is involved with their purchases right now, why they're spending $120 billion a month on those purchases. And this tape, basically, they're going to be slowing that down and bringing that back. And the tapering process is apparently going to likely begin in December. So, they're going to announce it in November, likely announce it in November and likely start in December and then completed by mid next year. And if you do a little bit of maths, then you can expect that tapering will finish, will be done at approximately $15 billion per month. So, every month from December, if that's when they start, to the end, to the middle of next year, they'll be pulling back about $15 billion per month. So, that's right. What we're expecting. They're finally winding that back in after ramping that up massively, obviously, at the start of the pandemic, which is when they started that. They raised it $120 billion per month. So, we'll kind of see what effect that has, right? Because if they're buying less government bonds, then and the government wants to continue to use the amount of debt that they are, then someone else is going to need to fill that demand gap. And if there isn't, anybody there to fill the demand gap at a 1% interest rate, then they might have to raise interest rates. They might have to sell treasury bonds at 2% or 3%. And that's where you see those, that 10-year treasury yield start to rise. So, we'll kind of be watching that. And then interest rates stayed at 0 to 0.25%. So, they basically stayed at zero. And half of the members of the board now expect a rate hike in 2022. So, we're really ramping up. We're going through the process of shifting monetary policy now. It's going from being very, very aggressive on the positive side to now it starting to wind back. We're probably going to see an interest rate increase next year. And we're starting to, the Federal Reserve is printing less money. They're not yet, but they're planning to plan to taper. So.
Thinking about. Yeah.
There you go.
This is to be expected, right?
Yeah, nothing really unexpected here. Yeah.
But yeah, I guess it's about that time. Were they doing it in the UK? Was it the UK that the central or Europe central bank was pulling back its support? Also, I can't remember.
Yeah, so the ECB.
But it's kind of that time, isn't
it? Yeah, so the ECB met, I think, last week or 2 weeks ago. And I mean, this is one of the reasons why European stocks have been kind of falling is because of this. But yeah, they're seeing, you know, levels of inflation they're not too happy with. And the ECB is making moves now to a little bit ahead of the US to taper, to reel in some of that money printing because of the higher inflation that's come in than they expected. So, you know, it's, yeah. I mean, mostly to be what's expected at the moment. Europe is kind of, European stocks are coming off a little bit because they weren't expecting it so soon. But, you know, it's one of those things right. That inflation will play a big role in all of this. Fed decisions will play a big role. We'll just have to see what happens to these metrics that we have no idea. We have no control over it. We can't make predictions about. So,
yeah. Oh, very interesting. Yeah. It's all happening. Wow. Man, 52 minutes we're into now. That's crazy.
Yeah, I know.
We've spoken about like two or three things.
We've spent a lot of time talking about debt and bonds. And
yeah, it's been a dense episode.
Yeah.
Very dense. A lot to understand in this episode. Should we do a couple of Q&A questions before we head on out?
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. Do you have you seen any that you're particularly interested in?
Let's have a look. Let's do this one here. So Buffett's first rule of investing is don't lose money. It's got me quite conflicted on how negatively he talks about safe and diversified portfolios. That's true. One of Buffett's rules is, you know, he believes in little diversification. So I don't know. What are your thoughts about diversification or safe defensive kind of portfolios? Do they have a place?
Yeah. So this is a really interesting question because it brings into conflict what people mean by risk, for example. Risk in Buffett's eyes is the uncertainty that's associated with future profits. So like we don't know in some businesses whether they will make money or not, whether they'll go out of business or whether, you know, they'll make $100 million or $200 million. And that is what we call risk, the uncertainty of future cash flows. Whereas there's another segment of the financial world that believe that risk is tied to volatility, that risk, a business is or a stock is riskier if its stock fluctuates wildly. And that's where you get, you know, the opinion that a wide diversified portfolio is safer than one that is concentrated because it will be less volatile over time. And that's, you know, comes into conflict with what Buffett thinks about don't lose money. Don't lose money to Buffett is don't invest in businesses that you think will produce a smaller amount of cash than you're paying for that business over time, or businesses that have a high risk associated with them in terms of going out of business. But that doesn't mean that you don't invest in companies because their stock prices will fluctuate wildly. In fact, a lot of the time, if you're investing in the way that Buffett is, then you will be investing in stocks and have a portfolio that will fluctuate a lot. You know, if a business goes through a short-term problem and its stock goes down a ton, you're happy to invest in that company and you don't mind if it continues to go down afterwards, as long as the underlying business is strong. And I think that's just a completely different, it's a completely different train of thought, investing in individual companies that you think are strong and disconnecting that from what the stock's price does, compared to the mainstream financial view, which is you want as much diversification as possible so that you have as little volatility as possible.
Yeah. To be honest, I just realized that I absolutely butchered that question.
Did you?
You want to know why?
Why?
Because I read my on the Google Doc, I was on the top of a page, but the page break split the question in half. So I actually only read you the second half of the question. However, it still worked as a question, and I think the answer you gave was quite good. The actual question was, hey guys, love the podcast and look forward to it every week. I have a question for the Q&A section. What are your thoughts on Robert Kiyosaki's advice regarding speculative stocks, mentioning over-the-counter stocks before they IPO, and losing makes you better returns / turns you into winners, in contrast with Warren Buffett's first rule of investing, which is don't lose money. It's got me quite conflicted on how negatively he talks about safe and diversified portfolios. But no, I still think what we were talking about before, Buffett's, Buffett's first rule of investing is definitely don't lose money. Yes, you can have a very diversified portfolio. And then, you know, it won't go up as much. It won't go down as much because it's so diversified. But it's more about the circle of competence, right? So Buffett, he just goes so in depth with his investments that, you know, he's still confident even without diversification. He knows he's within his circle of competence. So he knows that he's not going to lose money or has a very low probability of losing money when he makes an investment in, you know, I don't know, Bank of America, for example. But overall, I think it really depends. Like, the whole idea of diversification, safe, defensive portfolios is really just dependent on what type of investor you are, really. I mean, if you want to just buy individual stocks and stick within your circle of competence, then just go for it. And in that case, diversification can be your enemy if you really understand the industry you're operating in. But if you're not someone that wants to pay attention and keep up with the financial markets all the time and whatever, then, I mean, just go wide diversification and be done with it. You won't get those huge, amazing percentage returns in your portfolio, but at the same time, you probably won't lose very much money over the long run either. So,
yeah. And I mean, on your point about, on Robert Kiyosaki's advice about speculative stocks and having just buying a bunch of speculative stocks before they IPO, I couldn't disagree more with that strategy. I think it makes very, very little sense to invest in a lot of different things that you have very little confidence will do well over time. I think there's very little evidence at least from what I've seen, to suggest that a strategy of buying a lot of different really speculative companies works. The vast, vast, vast majority of speculative small companies that have an IPO'd or about to, or have just IPO'd, the vast majority of them go bust very quickly. Mm. Even if you buy a lot of them, it's very unlikely that you'll hit a winner based on that. I would much rather invest in companies I'm extremely confident will do well. Yeah, that's kind of my view on that.
The way I see it is kind of like that Robert Kiyosaki idea is kind of like, you know, going to a roulette table and then just putting a bet on every single number.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, sure, one of them's going to win, but you're still going to lose money.
Yeah, that's it.
Because the house always
wins. That's a good way of putting it. Yeah, it would be like, yeah, it's like that. If you went to a roulette table and, well, I don't know how many numbers there are, 36 or something like that, and you put, you know, 10 bets down, right? You put 10 bets on individual things and say, they're all very low chances.
Chances are one of them will do
well.
They're
all very low chance of winning, but if I hit one of them, I'll make 36 to 1. But the roulette table is a good example, because you can see that you still have a very small chance of even hitting one of them. And there's a good chance that you might hit none of them. And then you lose a lot. So, I think don't lose money is a good way to approach investing. But you have to be clear that that doesn't mean that your investments will never go down. In fact, a lot of the time, if you follow Buffett's advice, they will be going down below what you purchase them. So,
Very true.
Yeah. That's
should we do one more?
Yeah, we should. It's funny. It's almost a completely different question.
I know. That's why I felt so bad when I realized. I was like, man, I've just absolutely butchered this person's question. I'm so sorry. All right, should we do one more? Have you found one that's looking tasty?
Yeah, I'll roll us into this one. This is another Buffett-related question. Hey, guys, love the podcast. How do you feel about the Buffett indicator? Is it still effective given the top tech businesses make far more than when the indicator was a good prediction of an overvalued market?
Yeah, this is interesting. I think the Buffett indicator is the Wilshire GDP, which compares the Wilshire 5000, which is an American total market index, and it compares it with the US GDP. So, yeah, the argument here is that the Wilshire GDP has just been going up, 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 up. I think Phil Town says it in his books, like, oh, if you hit a Wilshire GDP of 100, then, oh, the stock market's really overvalued.
Yeah.
And now it's sitting at like 100 and... Let's have a look. Let's get this right. Things like 180 Wilshire GDP. Let's just give me 2 seconds. Talk amongst yourself, everybody. It is currently at doop de doop de doop.
Wow. Or something?
Okay, I was wrong. 245%.
Oh. Oi.
So, yeah, I mean, you look at that and you're like, holy smokes, this is so, so overvalued. But the argument against it is that it's not as relevant anymore because so much of the American market is tied up in those big behemoth tech giants that make money all over the world. So, they were saying that, but then again, would that count as... Yeah, so US GDP it compares it to. So they'd suck in money from all over the world, and would that count as US GDP? Probably not if they make it overseas, right?
Yeah, look, I'll be honest, I'm not exactly sure, but
I would have imagined
that maybe it counts in exports, but which is included in GDP, but maybe not. There's a couple of different ways you can calculate GDP, so that might play a role as well, but
right.
Yeah.
Now this has got me thinking, I thought I knew the answer and now I'm not so sure anymore.
Yeah. I mean,
anyway, I'll figure it out.
Yeah. I mean, I think about it in the same way as I think about, say, like the Shiller PE, which is a measure of, you know, how frothy the market is overall. The way I think about individual businesses is I'm comparing the price of the business to the cash flows that business can produce in the future. And on an individual business, I think I might be able to do that. But when it comes to the whole US economy, that's not something I think I can do. So, I generally kind of stay back from trying to figure out whether the market overall is overvalued, which kind of, in my view, depends on having a projection about what the cash flows of the entire market, all of the businesses within it, will be in the future. And that's something I don't think I can do. And that's kind of why I don't really care too much about these indicators. I just prefer to look at businesses on an individual basis. But yeah, I mean, a lot of people look at these indicators and use them, but it's not something I personally spend too much time on.
Yeah, no, that makes it. Sorry, I've been researching the background. I'm annoyed that I don't know. I thought I knew, and then I'm like, hang on, maybe I don't. I'll have to come back to that one, and I'll try and figure it out for next week's podcast. But yeah, no, I agree with what you're saying, though. I mean, you don't want to really be reliant on this metric or that, you know, this chart or that chart or this market indicator or that market indicator when you're looking at making investments. Because, I mean, chances are you'll find something that'll say, no, don't invest, and then you'll be out of the market. And then, oh, look, the market's gone up by 50%, and you've just been on the sidelines. So, yeah. I feel much the same as you in that aspect, in that regard. Mm. But should we wrap things up?
Yeah, let's do it.
Jeez, what an episode that was.
Very, very dense, for sure.
It's dense. I need to go take a nap. Do a Monish Pabri and take a midday nap.
Oh dear. Thanks everyone for tuning in. As always, if you have questions, feel free to head over to the YouTube version of the podcast and leave us your questions as a comment on the latest episode, youtube.com/theyounginvestorspodcast. Thanks ShareSite for sponsoring. As always, ShareSite.com/youninvestors. Head over to that link if you want to try a plan for free or try a paid plan and get 4 months off a yearly subscription. Thanks, Brandon, for joining me, as always.
All good, friend.
Maybe hopefully we can get in a live podcast, you know, within the next couple of months. I don't know. Maybe.
Hopefully.
Maybe.
Don't think it's happening for episode 150, but...
No, no, definitely not.
Hopefully we can do something soon.
Yeah, we'll hope so. We'll keep you posted if we're going to be able to do something like that. But with that said, thanks everyone for tuning in, and we'll see you guys next week.
See you later.